Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. In St. Paul, I'm Desiree Cooper.
And also in St. Paul, I'm John Moe, in for Bill Radke. This 4th of July weekend, we are celebrating America by bringing you all sorts of stories from all across this land of ours, from a First Amendment squabble over what to name a sewage treatment plant, to a first weekend of freedom for a Burmese family resettling in Texas. We'll also hear from descendants of people who were here long before George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and those other guys, how American Indians are celebrating the 4th. So it's fireworks season. Which one's your favorite?
Oh, the ones that they shoot up and then they explode and then they change colors on the way down.
The kind that make that sort of crackling glitter that lasts for a really, really long time and fall down really slowly.
I really don't enjoy fireworks since my experience in Vietnam, but I would like anything that's red, white, and blue clustered.
The Saturn missiles. They are the box with like 50 little missiles in them, and they go everywhere, and they're kind of loud and noisy, so I like those a lot.
Don't look at me. I like them all. They just have to be far, far away. That's
really?
All I care about.
You don't enjoy the rocket's red glare too.
I don't want the lawn
you.
On fire, no. that's not fun.
It's not part of the pyrotechnic display. I like the woman who said that she likes the ones that shoot up and explode.
Oh, those.
You know, those fireworks, the exploding kind. Those voices came to us from Chicago and also from Morgantown, West Virginia.
Well, this 4th of July, we celebrate what makes us uniquely American, like the constant influx into this country of people from all over the world. This weekend, we bring you another in our continuing series of First Weekend Home. Now, typically, those stories have been about soldiers and their first weekends when they come home from the war. But this weekend, we follow an immigrant family that's seeing home for the first time in America. Reporter Tori Marlin brings us the story of a family of refugees from Burma, now called Myanmar. And this is the first of many weekends that they hope to spend in Austin, Texas.
Just a week ago, Burmese exiles Thot Thi Thu, his wife Nolahe, and their three children were living in a refugee camp in Thailand. Now they're sitting in the back of a strip mall office in Austin, listening to a volunteer for Refugee Services of Texas teach them basic survival skills, like how to call 911.
When you say 911, they understand it's an emergency. I'm going to learn this English word, help.
Help.
Help. Yeah, everybody just say it once. Help.
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 Help is something the family will need a lot of in the coming days and weeks. Thot Thi worked as a rice farmer in Burma, not exactly a marketable skill here. He's part of the Karen ethnic minority, which came under particular attack when a military junta seized power in 1988.
Burmese soldiers forced me to work for them. And that's the worst thing because I don't have time to work to support my family. I just have to work for them.
The soldiers burned down their village and the couple fled with their children. They walked through the jungle for 2 weeks until they reached a refugee camp in Thailand. There they lived for the next 10 years in a small bamboo hut, cooking with wood, relying on candlelight, and sleeping on floor mats.
Hi, welcome. Welcome.
Now, Sophia Cassini, the director of Refugee Services of Texas in Austin, shows them around their new two-bedroom apartment.
This is to turn on the light for the electricity.
The family crouches under a lamp, wrapped as Cassini brightens and darkens the room. She invites the couple's 18-year-old daughter, Seta Ble, to give it a try. The girl has trouble with the twisting motion.
Do it this way.
The line.
Give your hand.
Finally, she gets it.
Yeah, good. And then do it again. Come and try it again.
Seta has a harder time with her bed. She's used to the floor, so that's where she sleeps. The comforts of their new home impress her mother more.
In the camp, I have to go and fetch the water, and everything is difficult for me. But in here, I can get the water easy, and everything is perfect for me, and like chair, sofa, is very nice for me.
Nola and her husband no longer have to collect their own water, but almost everything else is a challenge. Cassini is there to help.
The first thing you want to do is connect them to food stamps, Medicaid, Social Security, and then as they're able to become more self-sufficient, they may or may not need it in the future, and the ultimate goal is that they won't.
Thot Thi and Nola will also need help finding jobs, enrolling their kids in school, recognizing food in a supermarket. Even a takeout menu left outside their door has the power to confound. They show it to their caseworker in case it's important. Anticipating these kinds of problems, Cassini has placed them in an apartment complex with other Burmese refugees who can ease their transition.
They don't like to isolate people. There are different philosophies, but I try very hard to put people where there's going to be other groups of either refugees or just immigrants from their home community.
So Cassini has arranged for a Karen neighbor named Mumu to have lunch with the family on its first Saturday here. Thothi welcomes her at the door with a few English words he's recently learned. But as soon as they sit down for black pepper soup, they start chatting away in Karen. They swap jet lag stories, and Mumu tells them where to buy fish paste. Making friends doesn't seem to be a problem for Thothi. He's already met two other families in the apartment complex.
If I see other people who look like refugees, I just go and ask, like, where are you from? Are you a refugee? If you are, we are friends.
Their Burmese neighbors prove that starting over is possible. The family is expected to support itself within 6 months. That makes Thothi a little nervous. He's not used to paying bills.
Now I have my own home and I have to pay for everything, like electricity, gas, water, and rent.
But his worries are small compared to the ones he had in Burma. And he's had more freedom in the last couple of days than he did in the previous 10 years. He marvels at the changes in his life.
It's safe here and peaceful, so I'm happy to stay here forever.
The family knows that it will take time to settle in. For now, though, they're feeling hopeful. Thothi has found work. He's cleaning hotel rooms downtown. And their daughter, Seta, is finally sleeping in her bed. In Austin, Texas, I'm Tori Marlin for Weekend America.
Well, this 4th of July weekend, maybe you're doing one of those all-American activities, hosting a barbecue, going to a ball game, maybe eating apple pie or hot dogs, though hopefully not simultaneously. Or maybe you're being a real patriot and championing democracy, trying to get someone to sign your petition, or walking quickly away from someone who's trying to get you to sign their petition. But in San Francisco this weekend, one group of petitioners is having no problem gathering signatures for a special and, I would say, historically odd political ballot initiative. We sent reporter Roman Mars to find out what's going on.
2 years ago, the people of San Francisco voted on Proposition J, which would make it the city's official policy to call for the impeachment of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. It passed with 59% of the vote. But that wasn't enough for some. A new group known as the Presidential Memorial Commission of San Francisco wants to make a permanent statement about how people here feel about the Bush administration.
This is a very rare initiative, and people will actually line up to sign it. We can get hundreds in a day, no problem.
You let them catch a glimpse of the sign, and they just come up to you and they want to hug you.
What is it that you're signing here?
I'm signing an initiative to rename our sewage plant the George W. Bush Sewage Plant. It's, I think, a great tribute to him.
The initiative co-authors are fixtures around the city now. Brian McConnell and Michael Jacinto fan out on the busy street corner of Church and Market, blaring patriotic music and carrying an American flag. They're already well past the number of signatures required to get on the ballot, but they're getting a few more for good measure. What started as a joke over beers has turned into a movement. With a dedicated group of volunteers, weekly gatherings, and costume street theater-style signature drives, they're having a great time, but not everyone is.
The first thing that came into my mind is another group of nuts putting something on the San Francisco ballot again.
That's Howard Epstein, chairman of the San Francisco Republican Party.
You know, there's a lot of people who don't like the president, but this isn't the way to do it.
Epstein vows to do everything he can to defeat the initiative, including get out the vote campaigns and speaking at every neighborhood group in the city. But they might want to consider joining forces with another party that's a little uneasy about the name change.
My name is Tony Winokur, and I'm the spokesperson for the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. The clear intent behind the backers of the initiative is to make negative statements about the president. You know, we think what voters may want to ask themselves is an award-winning treatment plant that's never had a single environmental violation the right thing to name after President Bush?
Brian McConnell understands the Utility Commission's concerns, but the opportunity for San Francisco to comment on the Bush legacy is too important.
50 years from now, there'll be a kid somewhere in a civics class learning about Mount Rushmore and Abraham Lincoln on the $5 bill and the George W. Bush sewage plant. They'll get it. And it will lead to a discussion about Iraq and, you know, $10 trillion debt and just, you know, the whole legacy that he left the country. One of the things we want to do is set a precedent for politicians that, you know, if you really screw up, and especially if you betray the trust of the public, there's lots of places that could be named after you, and they're not libraries.
In fact, talk has already begun about the treatment plant's renaming, set for January 20th, Inauguration Day next year. Spokesperson Tony Winokur says the Public Utility Commission is going to roll with it.
It's quite possible that should it pass, we'll have a dedication ceremony, as would be appropriate for the renaming of any major facility, and maybe we'll even invite the president, who at that point might have a little more time on his hands.
What do you imagine the scene will be like on January 20th at the formerly Oceanside Water Pollution Control Plant?
Mission accomplished.
We'll make sure there's a big mission accomplished banner. We'll find a flight suit.
In San Francisco, and only in San Francisco, I'm Roman Mars for Weekend America.
And petition gatherers are well stocked with extra supplies of irony, and they're on the streets of San Francisco this weekend. Kind of makes you wonder how that measure would do in Crawford, Texas.
I wouldn't try it.
I don't think so.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.